The very first fossil that was recognized as an early human was a Neanderthal. This was in a German quarry in 1856. Bones, including a partial skull, were uncovered, and it blew people's minds. This discovery of another version, another type of hominid, had profound implications for the way people thought about the origins of humanity and what it meant to be human. And maybe because of that, the archaeologist Rebecca Ragg Sykes says, we used to think of Neanderthals as dullard losers on a withered branch of the family tree. She has a new book called Kindred, where she explores the new discoveries and scientific findings that have revealed just how remarkable and impressive they were. Ragg Sykes says Neanderthals were survivors. They were explorers. They pioneered new ways to be human. They expanded themselves through space and time. So you can see why she's so fascinated by them. And it's not just work for her. It's personal.
One of the things that really motivated me to talk about Neanderthals and the deep past is the experience of actually being an archaeologist. You know, I think many people might have a misconception that we are 100% dry, totally objective, and fully immersed only in scientific analysis of what we do. But I think most archaeologists, if they're honest, do have an emotional connection to the past. And that's why I chose to begin Kindred in the introduction by describing a conference that's held at Gibraltar, which is a famous place for Neanderthals. It was one of the earliest sites where there were any fossils found. And every year, scientists go, they give their papers, and they visit the caves. And there was this amazing video that was posted that showed one of the attendees, who's actually a biologist, getting out a guitar and actually singing a self-composed song in this cave.
Pull the lid down on my face. Feel the cold wind steal my dreams.
An ode to the last Neanderthal.
Baby sun, warm my back.
And I just found that incredibly striking and really refreshing that somebody would express that connection from an artistic place.
200,000 years of peace.
I think there is more of a personal connection to archaeology across the board. And actually sort of being okay with having a human interest in the past as well as a scientific one is one of the reasons why I've written this book. And I've tried to recreate scenes from the past to communicate that to other people as well.
You say that whether we'll ever be able to glimpse the, as you put it, the subtle reality of who Neanderthals were is going to be in some ways revealed by the conversations that scientists are having about all of that. You call the book a window into those discussions. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I personally can't help imagining scenes when I read scientific journal articles, you know, it just happens. And I think for a lot of my colleagues, there is something of that going on. And it's that sort of excitement, that little window onto what studying Neanderthals and deep human prehistory, what that's actually like. I was trying to communicate that as well. I mean, as I say, I didn't really want it to be a blow-by-blow account. It's more of a distillation of the scientific data and then kind of bringing out the speculation, the informed speculation that we do as archaeologists to try and make that leap into connecting many realms of data that we have and actually forming a window onto the past.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Rebecca Ragg-Sykes is an archaeologist and a research fellow at the University of Liverpool. Her book is Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death, and Art. And she told us this week that the sheer amount of information about Neanderthals is hard to process because there's a lot of it. And that's because people have been fascinated by them as soon as they were discovered because, as she puts it in the book, Neanderthals have always mattered.
They were the first hominins that we encountered. So by hominin, I mean a member of the Homo genus lineage that we are members of and our sort of forebears going back to our last common ancestor with our closest living relatives, which is chimpanzees. And that last common ancestor lived around 7 million years ago. And the Homo genus emerges around 2 million years ago. After that, all the different species that are classified as Homo, they're hominins. So they're all our relatives. They're not necessarily all on a direct line to us. But the first time we ever actually realized that such a thing as a hominin existed was with the Neanderthals. They were the first that we encountered that we really understood that there had been other ancient human relatives walking the earth.
Why do you think there is, you write about this early on in the book, there's this fascination with Neanderthals in popular culture, for example. Talk a little bit about why you think that is and how much of this popularity is based, you know, on actual science. Because you say most people have rough ideas about it, but it's not really about, it doesn't seem like it's an accurate portrayal, the kind of stereotype or caricature that we have of Neanderthals.
I think that the heritage of Neanderthals that I'm speaking about, that they've been there from the beginning, they were like the first that we found, is actually really significant for that, because they have been like a foil, you know, like a dramatic foil to us the whole way through, that we've gone on this journey of discovering human origins for the past 160 years. And they were the original ones that we compared ourselves to and measured ourselves against, rightly or wrongly. Mm. So I think they have been there from the beginning. They were being sort of drawn on and inspiring some of the nascent science fiction and fantasy literature, you know, in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. So they've always been something that I think has inspired people, but also frightened people. The fact that certainly until the past decade, when we realized that technically they're not totally extinct because there was interbreeding, but in practical terms, they vanished 40,000 years ago. And the idea of extinction is kind of scary, you know? And so we, I think, have for a long time have consistently looked at them and said, well, they messed up. Why? And are we doing better? And surely we are still here because we're better. Mm. And so it's very complex. They're a mirror, basically, to what we want to be, what we might be frightened that we could be. And, you know, it's no coincidence that in some of the early literature about them, fictional literature, I mean, you know, it's very much based in conflict. One of the most famous novels about Neanderthals is William Golding's The Inheritors. Yeah. And we are the bad guys in that big time. Yeah. And I think that's woven all the way through into where we are now, which is a complete change in how we view Neanderthals.
A good part of the book is, you know, the technology over the last three decades that, as you say, has been this kind of renaissance in Neanderthal research. What can the science tell us about the lives of Neanderthals? I mean, one thing you mention is that I think you say if you add it all up, all the fragments and the teeth that have been found so far, maybe fewer than 300 Neanderthals that we've actual individuals we've been able to identify. But on the other hand, you say that we can almost spy over Neanderthals' shoulders with some of the insights that we're getting. So what can science tell us?
Yeah, I mean, this is the interesting tension in studying Neanderthals. This is why I like it, because it is very challenging. I mean, you know, okay, compared to, say, the number of Roman skeletons that we have, 300 Neanderthals sounds pathetic, but actually it's massive. There are no other hominin species where we have anywhere near that number of individuals to look at. Yes, many of those are fragmentary, you know, maybe a jaw, and that's one individual from a site. But on the other hand, we do actually have quite a number of relatively complete skeletons, in the certainly probably over 20, 30, something like that now, if you look overall, and across a wide range of ages as well. You know, we can track the Neanderthal life in terms of beginning at birth. We have tiny, tiny newborn skeletons. We have toddlers, school-age kids, gawky-looking teenagers, and, you know, prime-age adults, right through to elders. Okay, I'm saying elders, that's kind of like 45 plus.
Right, right.
But in terms of the anatomical understanding of what they looked like and their life history, it's a very rich sample. And even if we had, you know, no ability to use archaeological science to look at the genetics or the diet through chemistry or things like this, even without that, you would still be able to say an awful lot about their lives just from their bones. But we actually have all these other techniques that can tell us about, you know, what they ate, the kind of injuries they had. But then we have the archaeology as well. We have all the stuff that they made and did. We've got millions of stone artifacts, literally millions. And we have organic objects as well. We have bone objects, but we also, in rare places, do have preserved wooden artifacts. And with the advent of many different techniques within archaeological science, we can look for tiny residues on things and work out, you know, that a black smudge on something is actually birch tar that has been cooked out of bark. And, you know, you start to really dive into the detail and the scale at which we can zoom down and look at what they were up to, like looking at micro layers within their hearths to see how hot it burned. You know, that's just mind-boggling, really.
It's interesting you mentioned that. You kind of say, if we're going to understand the story, we have to sort of start in the midpoint of it, and that is to the birth of human evolution as a science. I wanted you to talk about that, because you say Neanderthals were really part of this debate of the time about what it meant to be human. And I wanted you to say something about that, because, you know, the discovery of skulls and bones and this conversation and saying, oh, it's in the genus Homo, that had some profound implications for its time. Well, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the paleontologists, they understood that there had been vanished worlds, you know, that dinosaurs and marine reptiles had been pulled out of cliffs in the south of England by Mary Anning from the early 19th century. But really from the 1850s, you're starting to see a coming together of the geology, that people were really understanding how the geological record forms, and that, you know, the principle, which seems obvious today, of what we call stratigraphy, which is basically that the oldest thing is going to be at the bottom of your site unless it's been disturbed. So that was beginning to be understood. Darwin and Wallace had been developing their theories about natural selection and evolution, and they published that in 1859. The first Neanderthal fossil from Germany, this was the Feldhofer fossil from the actual Neanderthal, so Tal is the German word for valley, that was dug out in 1856, but it wasn't published until 1858, 1859, so literally just at the same time as, you know, these famous Darwin and Wallace's work was coming out. It's, you know, just everything is happening at the same time. And there was this other thing going on where people had been digging in sites and also in rivers, caves and rivers, in river terraces, gravel terraces, and finding what were clearly humanly made objects, you know, so hand axes, big stone objects, but with no fossils, but in situations that were so deeply buried that they clearly had to be incredibly old. And there'd been a lot of arguments as, oh, you know, can this be explained by biblical flood deposits? Is it possible? And that was going back and forth. And it was really only, you know, that last half of the 19th century when all of these things joined together that it really was understood how old the Earth was. Yes, there had been other kinds of hominins before, and it took until the 1880s until Neanderthal fossils were actually discovered with artifacts. Until that point, there was no knowledge that they had actually even had culture. Really, even by the early 20th century, sort of 1910, 1911, there were still wildly differing views on what Neanderthals looked like, you know, and what their lives might have been. There are these famous illustrations from the London Illustrated News of sort of two Neanderthals. One was published in 1910, and it looks incredibly, you know, apish and brutish and aggressive. And then the year after, illustration was published by a different anthropologist showing a Neanderthal who looks, you know, incredibly domestic, sitting by a fire, nice tidy beard, he's actually got a necklace on, he's kind of, you know, doing a little bit of work on some tools. And, you know, that's, they were 1 year apart. So the idea of what Neanderthals were and how controversial they were carried on for decades after they had first been found. And it was because, you know, the implications were not just theoretical in terms of where do Neanderthals fit in our history. Are we direct descendants from them, or are they a branch that came off earlier and they've got nothing to do with us, and we can, you know, not have to consider them in terms of whether they were, to use the language of the time, civilized or not. Right. And so there were these theoretical ideas and debates, but also from the get-go, Neanderthals were drawn in to sort of systems of classifying living people that were dominant at that time, where basically white Europeans were regarded as the epitome of human development, physically and culturally. And Neanderthals were explicitly compared and likened to the peoples and the cultures who at that time were regarded as inferior, which was hunting-gathering peoples from Aboriginal peoples in Australia, native peoples from the Americas, and also Black people. Yeah. And so Neanderthals were explicitly used to justify colonial structures that were there, you know, that had replaced slavery. So it was intensely political, even from the beginning, and that ran right through the middle of the 20th century. And, you know, there were people, anthropologists even in the 60s, who sort of still were publishing on these ideas that certain kinds of people from around the world were less evolved. So that's why the Neanderthals mattered early on, and why there were so many debates about what they meant, because it wasn't just an intellectual pursuit. It actually reverberated into how we understand ourselves.
That's Dr. Rebecca Ragg-Sykes. Her book is Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death, and Art. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
With KUER's mobile app, you can listen to our live programming stream and all of our station's services. Catch up with local stories from KUER News and enjoy KUER podcasts like Radio West. You'll also find our uninterrupted streams of BBC World Service and classical music. The KUER mobile app is available for free on Apple and Android devices. Download it wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the British archaeologist Rebecca Ragg-Sykes is with us talking about Neanderthals. She has a new book that explores the discoveries trying to unfold the layers of complexity in what we know about them. Questions like, where did Neanderthals live? How complex were their social networks? Did they make art? Her book is called Kindred. You mentioned that if you stood face-to-face with a Neanderthal, that they would be recognizable as a kind of human. But you say unconventional. Explain what you mean. Like, what would it be like if I stood face to face with one? And for that matter, what would it be like to shake their hand?
Well, I think contrary to a lot of the reconstructions that were made early on where they did look very apey, they're kind of bent over. And, you know, you still see that in many of the sort of March of Progress images where you have like it's chimps begin and they're all bent and then eventually it gets up to us and we're all straight and tall and wonderful. But the hominin before us usually still looks all bent over and, and you know, a little bit uncertain about themselves. But I think people should really get rid of that image. Neanderthals were completely bipedal. They walked on two legs. They were athletic. They weren't sort of cringing around and being, you know, just a bit uncertain as to whether they were even part of our lineage. Mm-hmm. They were shorter than us on average, and they did have different body proportions in that they basically just a bit stockier. And this is probably to do with the fact that they did evolve at a higher latitude than us. And as with many creatures who are in broader, colder conditions, non-tropical, basically, they have rounder bodies because it's better at retaining heat. So shorter, more stocky. They were probably a little bit stronger. We certainly can see that on many of the skeletons, even in children, you can see strong evidence of the bones thickening from use and also from muscle attachments that does show that they were very, very active. And this is part of the hunter-gatherer life, you know, that you just have to be extremely active to survive. And then you can kind of see sort of other differences in their face. You know, they have a big face. They have a larger nose that's more protruding. The whole of the front of their face is sort of slightly more pulled forwards than ours. Ours is tucked right under our forehead, really. If you feel where your forehead is, most of your face, apart from the tip of your nose, is really underneath your brows. Neanderthals, it was pulled forward a bit more. They did have large brow ridges, big eyes, and the shape of their head is different too. So we have much more of a, you know, a globular, like a balloony kind of head. Theirs stick out a little bit at the sides, but it's overall, it's more kind of pulled back and aerodynamic. And yeah, certainly if one offered you their hand, then they probably would have had a very strong grip. And been, you know, you wouldn't want to arm wrestle one. But that's not to say that they lacked fine dexterity. What we can understand is that some of the fine, subtle differences in the strength of their finger-to-finger grip might have been a bit different. But overall, we know that they were dexterous and able to handle tiny things skillfully because we can see it in the archaeology. They did make tiny little flakes and bladelets, which were presumably hafted, so glued onto something else to actually use onto a handle. So we can see, not only from their bodies, but from the archaeology, that they were in no way brutish.
You say their lifespan was unique. Do you have a sense of what it was like to grow up like a Neanderthal? I mean, when you look at the teeth and the bones of Neanderthal children, for example, you mentioned there's this suggestion that they grew up, I think this is how you put it, at a slightly different tempo than us. Explain this too, because you mentioned at birth that their skulls started out in some ways similar to ours, but that the shape was different. Like if you cradled a Neanderthal baby, you said it would have felt a little unexpected. The skulls are shaped differently.
Yeah, I mean, overall, if you saw a Neanderthal newborn and didn't look that closely, you know, they're pretty much exactly the same size. They're going to look like a newborn baby. But yeah, they already had the different shaped skull. They didn't have large brow ridges yet, but they lacked a chin. All Neanderthals lacked a chin, and Neanderthal newborns also lacked a chin. But the bridges of their noses were already slightly further forward, so their faces may have already looked a bit more sort of pulled out. And yes, at the back of the skull, I said the skull shape overall is kind of more swept back, flatter than ours. But at the back, there was a little nodule called an occipital bun. It's where the visual system is, and that's more pronounced in them. And that is there in newborns. So there are features that you would have been able to see even in babies were different. But in terms of how they grew, it's very complicated to actually address this because, you know, we have, as I said, we actually have a lot of fossils from different points in life. But to track how bodies grow, you end up having to model things.
Yeah.
And, you know, look at that process. And you really need to know exactly how old those children were in order to be able to compare it to living children's development. And one of the best ways to do that is to look at the tiny little lines inside your teeth that are formed every sort of few days as you grow. And you can count them, you know, with incredibly powerful microscopes and scanning sort of technologies. You can actually count those and work out how old that child was, because we know when that tooth was growing. And, you know, so you can get a fixed handle on age. And for a while, people were assuming that perhaps Neanderthals grew faster than us, because it appeared that some of the teeth were emerging, you know, like kids get their teeth at a particular age, right? In a particular order most of the time. And you can look at the size of the jaw and see how many teeth have come through. And that's a more sort of rough way of aging before we had the technology to look at these actual fine lines in the teeth. And it appeared that maybe they grew a bit faster. But it does get more complicated. In some individuals where we can look at the exact age, it looks as if they weren't all necessarily growing slightly faster than us. There's a boy from Spain who seems to have been a bit of a slow grower. And, you know, it's just like today. Some kids develop faster, others sort of stay like little minnows for a bit longer. And they're the small ones in the class. But overall, they're probably, if you look at all the different parts of the body, all the different ways we have to assess growth, they may have been ever so slightly ahead than us. But over the whole lifespan, it wouldn't mean that they were going to die much sooner than us. You know, in terms of basic biology, there's no reason why Neanderthals couldn't have lived to 60 or 70. The question of whether they did or not comes down to how hard their life was. But yeah, they could certainly have developed. And although their brain shape as they grow as their children, you know, it begins to look like a Neanderthal brain, it does look as if the parts of the brain were developing at about the same rate as ours, which would mean that you were more or less hitting the same milestones as a baby, as human babies. You know, you would be crawling around the same time, you would be starting to stand up, starting to vocalize around the same time. But, you know, I mean, human babies today are very variable in that anyway.
Well, so it raises two questions. You mentioned vocalize. So I'm sure they made sounds. I guess the question also comes up, maybe we can get to that in just a second, is whether or not they had language, whether they communicated, how they communicated, how they, if they, in some way of putting it, spoke to each other. Mm-hmm. But to the brain question, what was going on with their brains in the sense, you point out that their brains were just as you say, big and deliberating as our own. So what do we know about – do all the theories, for example, of how human brains manage to – you know, human beings manage to evolve large brains, does that apply to Neanderthals in the same way, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look like I said at the beginning, if you look at where the overall story of human evolution begins, when we have our last common ancestor with chimpanzees 7 million years ago, then the genus – Homo emerges around 2 million years ago. They're still quite small brained at that point, although we do now know that there were stone tools being made, although very crude, more than 3 million years ago. So actually that's pre-Homo. That's in the Australopithecines, these other kind of creatures that listeners might have heard of. Lucy, you know, she's one of these Australopithecines 3 million years ago. But in the greater span of where Neanderthals are in that story, they're actually really close to us in time. You know, 350,000 years ago, we begin emerging, so were they. There's like a parallel sort of story. And our common ancestor with Neanderthals was only 650,000 years ago, and then our two lineages sort of split and went off and did our own thing. So in that sense, they are very close to us. And purely biologically, you would expect there on that basis to be pretty similar, if you look at their overall bodies, to how we develop. But specifically about the brains, they had a brain boost in size just as we did. That goes back to our common ancestor with them. It's really sort of from, I guess, a million years, 800,000, that the brains really begin to start getting bigger. And so that sort of growing in size began with our common ancestor with them. So they have, on average, brains that are about the same size as ours, if not slightly larger. That's one of the facts that a lot of people actually, you know, have heard about Neanderthals, that their brains are actually bigger than ours. That might actually be an artifact of the fact that many of the more complete Neanderthal remains that we have might be male, which tend to have slightly bigger brains. And when you compare the Neanderthal sample that we have with only human males, the difference, you know, they're looking bigger than ours shrinks somewhat, because you're comparing them with the larger part of the human sample. So, but certainly you can say that they had brains as big as ours. And in that sense, we would expect them to have had a very complex social and cognitive development through their early years, just as we see in our children. They had a childhood, biologically speaking.
Yeah. So what about speech? Do we know? Is there any way of knowing whether or not they, you know, put words together? What can we even say about the way they may have communicated, the way they may have vocalized?
Yeah, I mean, language is one of the big, you know, controversial areas with Neanderthals, because it's so relevant to our lives. We can't imagine not having communication. And it's complex because there's different ways you can look at it. You can say, well, did they have the vocal box, you know, the voice box, like ours? And it does appear that there's a bone called the hyoid in your throat, which supports your voice box. And we have found Neanderthal hyoids, and based on the rest of the proportions of their neck and their skull and things, it looks as if they're pretty much similar to ours in terms of placement, and therefore that the range of sounds their vocal cords could produce were probably reasonably similar. There may have been some differences with vowel sounds and things like this. So they had, you know, the equipment in that sense. Then you can look at the anatomy of their inner ear, because there's little tiny bones in there that are preserved in skulls. And although it looks like their inner ear bones, they are different to ours, that appears to have been something that happened as their skulls took on a unique shape, different to our common ancestor, just as ours became unique and weird in its own sense. But the really fascinating thing is, although their inner ears are differently shaped to ours, they seem, based on sound modelling, to be tuning into the same frequency that our ears are, which is human speech. So that implies that not only was some kind of vocal communication very important to Neanderthals, as it is for us, but also it was in our common ancestor somewhere around 650,000 years ago. So some kind of talking must have been going on and important. But could they do what we're doing right now, you know, having a complicated discussion about theories, talking about the past, the future, things that aren't here, long sentences, all of this? That is a really different question.
Rebecca Ragg Sykes, her book is Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death, and Art. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Week Weekends are kind of a toss-up. Sometimes we're productive, and other times we're lazy. But no matter where you are on the scale of busyness, KUER is ready to spend the day with you. On your smart speaker, just tell it to play KUER. And
wait, don't tell me the
end. This is All Things Considered from NPR.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Have a laugh, stay informed, and ultimately enjoy your weekend with NPR Utah. Tell your smart speaker to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, a little love for Neanderthals, or at least some respect. The British archaeologist Rebecca Ragg-Sykes has a new book that paints a 21st century portrait of Neanderthals. And she says they weren't knuckle-dragging dullards. They were clever and impressive, though we don't really know why they disappeared. Her book is Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death, and Art. What do we understand about what happened to them, where they went, why they disappeared? I mean, the idea of it, I had the sense of, like, did they slowly fade away? Or I got a sense from the book that it was something more abrupt than that. And I wondered, you know, what part in the extinction of that species did we Homo sapiens play? Because you get a sense also that we didn't really – didn't sound like we annihilated them. We just outcompeted them, that in some way there's a limit to – there's an adaptability question here as to what happened. What can we say that we know about this?
Well, it is really just one of the hardest questions of this. It's the one so many people want to answer. And I didn't really want to address it till the end of the book. I spent most of the book just talking about Neanderthals because I wanted to look at them on their own terms and forget the fact that they vanished and, you know, ignore that bit because it sort of colours how people view them so much. But of course, you do need to address it. And what we now see, there's sort of several things going on. Many of the aspects of their behaviour and even their biology that seemed to be, you know, red lines between us and them have kind of been erased somewhat over the past few decades. You know, it used to be claimed, or well, maybe they weren't that great hunters and they just scavenged everything. Then we realized that actually they were really good hunters. Then it was like, oh, maybe they only ate big game and they were stuck in a big game rut and they couldn't eat all the small game, and that's what we did and that's why we were better. But then it turned out, no, they could do that too, and yes, they ate plants. So the subsistence argument that was one of the strongest sort of aspects of discussion as to why we were supposedly more successful and outcompeted them, that really doesn't stand up very well at all now. The other thing that has changed is that we've known roughly for quite some time when they disappeared. It's been honed down now to about 40,000 years ago. And so that's the point at which we don't see Neanderthal fossils after that date, really. And we also don't see the archaeology that is associated with them anymore either. That changes. And that kind of was assumed to be the case for a long time. And the theory was that it was around then that early Homo sapiens had begun to disperse from Africa, encountered the Neanderthals and swept them away somehow, or outcompeted them, or, you know, whatever, they were replaced. The difference now is that we can see two things. We can see that early Homo sapiens were leaving the African continent far, far before that. Right. The earliest people in Australia now, like 60 to 65,000 years ago. In China, 80 to 120,000 years ago, easily. Even in the Near East, you know, 150, 180,000 years ago. So we left a lot earlier, or at least there were waves of dispersals of early Homo sapiens leaving much earlier. So we were in Eurasia for a long time with Neanderthals, yet they didn't disappear. And connected with that, all this time that we now know that we were actually in the same continent as them, you think, well, what were we doing? Well, the answer is, at least some of the time, we were having sex. A decade ago, we had the first evidence from the first nuclear genomes from Neanderthals that there definitely had been interbreeding.
Right.
And that picture now has also become more complex. So there was interbreeding, and the genetic legacy in most living people that comes from Neanderthals, we now think, comes from a period around 55,000 years ago. So, you know, 10, 15,000 years before they vanish.
Yeah.
we know that there was interbreeding going on right up till just before 40,000 years ago. So the sort of the tapestry of our interaction has got incredibly complex and interwoven. So we are talking about babies. Yeah. You know, we're talking about babies being raised. And so that's a really fascinating question as well. What were the circumstances for those, you know, for us having sex? Was it consensual? Was it not? Probably it was a mix in different times and places. And we've got to remember Neanderthals lived across an enormous range. Right. So the processes of their end, we should expect it to be different in different places and at different times.
I really liked the idea that some Neanderthals, and I was really stunned by this, I have to say, there may have been ginger Neanderthals, redheads, lighter colors, maybe freckles, things like that. Talk a little bit about that. That image really maybe shattered my own stereotype that I've put together. But they lived in these higher latitudes, so I guess it makes sense in some ways that they were lighter, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to sort of the rather, you know, racist early representations of Neanderthals. Some of them have clearly been shown with very dark skin, you know, in the early 20th century. And it's interesting how that idea gets embedded. Yeah. But in terms of biology, yeah, we would not expect Neanderthals to have had very dark skin because they are up in the northern latitudes. They need the vitamin D, you know. So overall, they're not going to be very, very dark toned. But we do see from different samples, from different individuals' genetic samples, that they were varied. Some of them were a bit darker than others, you know, had darker looking hair or paler. I mean, I say darker or red hair. Yes, red hair and freckle. What the genetics actually is that it's the same sort of set of genes that in us look like that.
Right.
We can't see how it was actually expressed in a Neanderthal because we don't have a real Neanderthal there. But, you know, overall, yes, there is diversity in what they look like, basically. And that shouldn't be a surprise. And, you know, they were living from Wales, Belgium, all the way through to Siberia, Central Asia, down into the Near East. That's a huge range of different environments, and different body types are going to work in different regions. And we can even see that Neanderthals in the Near East, for example, where we actually have quite a few skeletons, they are more lightly built than ones living up in Northern Europe, which makes sense because of the, you know, the thermal aspect going on there. You want to be able to lose heat better where it's hotter. So sure, they definitely were a varied population. And so I think we should remember that there is this range of their own experience that we have to take account of.
Struck by their noses, how a Neanderthal might have smelled. I mean, you mentioned what they might have smelled, pine resin and horse sweat and old smoke. But also you say that because they had these large noses, they could suck in air at twice the rate that Homo sapiens could. So that made me wonder, were they better conditioned? Did they have better endurance than Homo sapiens? Were they better athletes? Maybe even better hunters? Do we have any sense of that?
Well, certainly, in terms of what we can see, the record of the animals that they were eating, it's clear that they were extremely skilled hunters, no question. But in terms of like their bodies and how they lived, As I mentioned earlier, we can see from the muscles and the thickness of the bone, you know, being very highly developed, that Neanderthals, even from childhood, were living very full-on lifestyles. And some of the sort of levels of physical development, muscle development, is equivalent to what we see in athletes today. So they were, you know, they were training hard, but they were living their training, you know. There was no practice for them. They just had to do it. So in that sense, they were very, you know, their bodies were used intensively. And this is one of the things that's quite interesting in terms of how we understand their bodies now that has changed. Although there's definitely an aspect to their overall physique that's connected to climate, sort of living in cooler climates than Homo sapiens evolved in Africa. They were not sort of living through one massive freezing ice age. There were multiple cycles of climate change. They did live in periods, glacial periods, we call them, when it was really cold. But they also lived in periods as warm as today, or even warmer. So they experienced all these different ranges of temperatures. So they were not Arctic adapted, like, you know, like an Arctic fox or a reindeer or a muskox. They weren't truly happy in the cold. So if you live in a variety of environments, your body's going to get honed for the really tough conditions, but it's going to be able to function in other periods too. So a lot of the explanations for the idiosyncrasies in their anatomy often in the past were, oh, well, maybe it's about the cold, like, oh, they have very large noses and very, you know, huge nasal apertures in the skull. You can see it's really striking. Maybe that was because their noses were conditioning air as the air went in to warm it up. Well, actually, more recent research has been focusing on this aspect of their lives as just being incredibly intensive. And what that has shown with their noses, lungs, other things, is that it's actually about fueling their bodies that were, although they're shorter, they're more massive than our bodies. They actually needed a ton more calories than us. You've got to get those calories by hunting or by intensive foraging, walking around the land, running. So it may be that there is like a feedback cycle happening with the intensity of their lifestyles as northern latitude hunter-gatherers, forcing this development of their bodies to be able to basically just manage the massive amounts of food that they had to have. So it's kind of like different aspects going on that does explain their bodies, partly from thermal consideration, but also from how they were living.
Let me ask you finally, what do you think what is the future in this story? What does it mean now, for example, that we can, as you put it in the book, recover Neanderthal DNA from dust? And there's some experimentation going on, splicing Neanderthal genes into mice, for example. I wondered what you made of this and what you make about the future and the study of Neanderthal, because you also mentioned stereotypes and cliches seem to be sticking around.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, a lot of people, if you say, oh, you know, I work on Neanderthals, a lot of people say, oh, they're not as stupid as we used to think, are they? And didn't they bury their dead? So some of the ideas that are that archaeology has been, you know, uncovering for the past 50 years, say, have filtered through. But it's all the really fine details that are fascinating about their lives, like that they managed their fires in different ways, and they had some fires that were blazing, and other times they had little ember fires, probably for sleeping next to, things like this, that they had not only sophisticated technology like with the birch tar, but they were probably really quite into skin working for clothing, probably, but also perhaps for shelters, things like this. There's all these different aspects of their lives that we have been, you know, really pulling out from the masses of data, and that I wanted to communicate that. But in terms of like the future of Neanderthal sort of research, the genetic side of things has obviously completely exploded in the past 10 years. The technology itself is advancing very quickly, and people have rapidly got better at being able to pull material out. We can understand better, you know, the kind of fossils that we need. Colder environments tend to be better. The DNA is not so degraded. But also, yeah, we can get material out from sediments now, which is, you know, absolutely amazing. And it opens up a huge area of things we can look at. But even in archaeology, we are getting massively better at being able to extract the tiniest pieces of information and find tiny residues and things like this that we didn't, you know, that the early pioneers in prehistory would have thought we were absolutely mad to say, oh yeah, we can find the starch residues from the grot in between a Neanderthal's tooth and tell you that they were eating water lily roots. They would not have believed that, you know, in the 1850s, but we can do that. What we really lack is, you know, the full picture. Like sometimes people say, oh, what would be your ideal Neanderthal find? And a permafrost Neanderthal, you know, one of these bodies preserved in Siberia, like, you know, you see the mammoths and there recently there have been incredible finds like cave lions and wolves and, you know, even a bird, you know, 46,000 years old. And if we found a Neanderthal body in the Siberian permafrost, that would tell us an enormous amount. It would be like when we found that famous body Ötzi, this later prehistoric guy from the Italian Alps. His body was amazing to find, but it was all the stuff on him that was really informative. You know, what did their clothes actually look like? What were they carrying around with them every day? What did they use to carry their stuff? You know, it's those questions that we can't see most of the time in the archaeology that actually tell you an awful lot about the reality of their existence. And that's what I would love. You know, I'd love to find a permafrost Neanderthal, whether we ever will or not, unclear, but certainly with, you know, the changing climate going the way it is, the reason we're getting all these creatures, you know, melting out is because it's warming up. So perhaps there is a Neanderthal waiting somewhere in Siberia.
Rebecca Ragg-Sykes, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Rebecca Ragg-Sykes. Her book is Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death, and Art. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.